This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. On the program this afternoon, we're going to talk about the marketing of religion. Our guest is a scholar of media who, before entering the academy, was a marketing executive. Our guest is Mara Einstein. She is the author of Brands of Faith, Marketing Religion in a Commercial Age. Mara Einstein argues religion is a product, and she says that in order to compete in a loud, cluttered marketplace, religious organizations have adopted the promotional strategies of that marketplace. So how are religious organizations marketing themselves? How good are they at it? Is this changing the way Americans practice their faiths? How? What impact is it having on the culture? Those are some of the questions we'll take up this afternoon in this portion of the program. Let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Mara Einstein is an associate professor of media studies at Queens College, as well as an adjunct professor in the Stern School of Business at New York University. In addition to Brands of Faith, she's the author of Media Diversity, Economics, Ownership, and the FCC. Brands of Faith, Marketing Religion in a Commercial Age is part of the Media, Religion, and Culture series from Routledge. For more information about the book and our guest, you can visit the website www.brandsoffaith.com. Professor Einstein, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this
afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
What led you to an interest in marketing and religion? Tell us the story of that day back at NBC.
Well, it actually started a long time ago. I'm what you probably call a seeker. I'm one of these people who spend a lot of time trying a lot of different faiths. So I've had an interest in religion and faith studies for a long time. But in terms of actually religion and the idea of marketing religion, that probably started in about the mid-90s. I was looking at this idea of how do we see religion portrayed within our culture. And actually, if you look at primetime television, if an alien came to the United States and watched primetime television, they would think we were not a religious culture at all. And the fact of the matter is we really are. And from my own interactions with faith as well, I began to feel myself every time that I did something, I had to pay for it. So I began to have these questions. What happens to religion? What happens to faith when you have to pay for it? And does that start to change it into a product? I was also at the time working at NBC, seeing a lot of research information coming across my desk, and one of the packets of research was about the idea of how religion was changing and how it was changing because of the different changes in the media culture, and that's what really sparked my interest in this, and more specifically in terms of marketing religion as opposed to more broadly media and religion, was how what I understood as a marketer and how that was changing, how the religious space was changing as well.
Yeah, the book's preface opens with quite a story, story about your going to check out the Kabbalah Center in New York City. Mm-hmm. What was going on there the day of your visit, and what was the message there that day?
Well, the Kabbalah Center is really interesting. When you go to the Kabbalah Center, they used to have open houses, and they stopped for a while, and actually they've introduced them again. And the day that I went, it was a huge mob down the street waiting to get into the Kabbalah Center, and they had big balloons outside and tables lined up, and you had to sign in, and they sign up, and you had to provide your email information and your phone number and your address, and so they could get back in touch with you again. And when you walked in the door, and this is what's really interesting about the Kabbalah Center, and this really shows the commercialization of this particular religious group. Actually, they don't call themselves a religion. I'll take that back. But this spiritual group, let's say that, is that you walk through the bookstore in order to enter the building. So before you can take a class, before you can attend a religious service, you have to walk through the marketing gauntlet, which is the bookstore. And in the bookstore, they're selling many books written by teachers from the Kabbalah Center. They're selling Kabbalah water. They're selling the Kabbalah red string. They're selling the names of God. There are 72 names of God that are written in three Hebrew letters, and different names mean different things. And you can buy those on key rings and necklaces and so on and so forth. So the commercialism of this particular place is very, very blatant. And then when you attend the actual open house, you go through, you listen to them providing information about different classes that they provide, and they're ready to sign you up the minute you walk in. But what's interesting is that Kabbalah itself has traditionally been the spiritual part of the Jewish faith, and it has been that traditionally you would have to be a man, you would have to be in your 40s at least, and that you would already have to have been a Talmudic scholar before you could ever take on understanding these very mystical ideas that are Kabbalah. And yet at the same time, there were many people around there saying, well, I'm not Jewish, can I sign up for this? And the guy signing them up said, sure, go ahead, I'm not Jewish either. So the bottom, the basis, the real heart of what is that practice has been taken out. And I talked to a rabbi who wasn't connected to the Kabbalah Center and said, well, what do you think about all of this? And he looked at me and he said, well, if you knew what Kabbalah really was, you wouldn't want to practice it, because it's very difficult. The real, true Kabbalistic faith is very, very difficult to practice.
Yeah. So who founded this center, and what's their motivation?
Well, the Kabbalah Center was started by who they call the Rav, Philip Berg, who was actually originally an insurance salesman in Queens, I believe. And what they claim is that they started the center because they wanted to be able to provide these Kabbalistic teachings to everyone, and that it shouldn't be something that is just held by older men, that it's important teachings, it's important for people to understand these spiritual principles, and they wanted to be able to provide that to the world. In and of itself, that seems like an okay thing. That doesn't seem so terrible. But if you spend any time at the Kabbalah Center, and I did spend time at the Kabbalah Center in New York, I also interviewed people from other Kabbalah centers, there's a real tension going on between the providing of the spiritual tenets, the providing of the religious practice, and a commercialism. So, for instance, if you want to attend the Kabbalah Center, almost anything you do there, you have to pay for, with the exception, perhaps, of the Saturday morning service. There's a dinner on Friday night, a Shabbat dinner, you pay for that. If you attend a Purim party, you pay for that. If you take a class, you pay for that. And some of these can be very, very expensive. You know, it's understandable to charge for certain events, but some of the prices charged for some of these things can be quite extensive. They have, for example, Passover might happen in a very expensive hotel. And the same thing is true for the High Holy Day services. They happen at very expensive hotels around the country. In and of itself, that may not be a big thing, because a lot of Jewish people will go to a hotel during Passover, because you have to, under very religious circumstances, you have to clean out your whole house and make sure there's no bread in your house and so on and so forth. So the fact that they're having Passover at a nice hotel is not that big a deal. The prices that they're charging to do that are substantially more than at some of the other places where people practice the Passover services or have the Seders and so on. And that's when you begin to question why they're doing this. They say all of the money goes back into the Kabbalah Center, but it's a pretty fine line when you look at the fact that the founder of the Kabbalah Center, the Rav, his wife, and then their two sons have side-by-side houses in Beverly Hills. And they claim that those houses, and the houses aren't owned by them, the houses are owned by the Kabbalah Center, but they're the ones that are living in those houses. So it gets a little muddy in terms of how that money is being used. They also claim that they're using the money to either go back into the center or to help other people. Again, you've got a question when large houses are being bought for the use of the people who run the institution, as well as buying new schools for the Kabbalah Center. The building in New York City, for example, is on the east side on 48th Street. It's a very, very expensive piece of property.
Is this a fad?
Kabbalah, I think Kabbalah, the Kabbalah and the Kabbalah Center, is that fad is starting to fade a little bit. We're not seeing the red strings quite as much. We're not seeing, you know, Madonna out promoting the Kabbalah Center quite as much as we used to. So some of that, I think, is a fad. Is the idea of marketing religion a fad? Absolutely not. Yeah. Absolutely not.
Yeah. And this is not anything new, but it's just now, it's like on steroids.
It absolutely is. I mean, a great example of that is Joel Osteen. You can't turn anywhere without seeing him right now. And Joel Osteen, for people who don't know, is the pastor of the Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, which is the country's largest megachurch. Now, I just finished writing the book and put the figure in that the congregation was 40,000 people. They're now claiming 45, 46, 47,000 people who attend the church on a weekly basis. So it's growing tremendously. They're using a lot of very sophisticated marketing techniques that are used by consumer products. And part of that has to do with branding, which is part of the reason why I call the book Brands of Faith, mm-hmm. rather than just like marketing religion, is that it has to do with the ability to be able to create a branded identity so that you can be perceived within a marketplace of a tremendous amount of commercial messages. We see 3,000 commercial messages on a daily basis. We may not be conscious of all of those, but we do see them. And so, for instance, if you were talking about Nike, for example, and someone sees the Nike swoosh, you automatically have ideas associated with that Nike swoosh. In reality, it's a line. It's all it is. It's a line. But because of all the advertising and marketing that surrounds it, you will think either Just Do It or the Best of Athleticism, or you might think that about overpriced shoes being made by women in third world countries. At the same point, what you see with Joel Osteen is the same idea of a brand, and a brand always has some kind of logo or person associated with it, a tagline, and a mythology, not a mythology in terms of religion, but a mythology in terms of the brand. So for Joel Osteen, you have Joel. He's known as the smiling preacher, so every time you see him, his picture is taken when he has a big smile on his face. And the mythology, for anyone who's spent any time watching his show or reading his books and so on, knows that he started as the runner of his father's television ministry. He never wanted to be out front. He was always the behind-the-scenes guy. And that his father, when his father was on his deathbed, asked Joel to take over the ministry. And Joel said no initially. He hung up the phone. He sat down, had his dinner, felt that God called him to take over the ministry. And so then he did. And in fact, felt so uncomfortable about it and so uncomfortable about his ability to fill his father's shoes that he literally wore his father's shoes for the first 3 years whenever he got up to the pulpit. Hmm. So there's... Now, whenever you see Joel Osteen, you see that smiling face, and you have all these ideas of who he is and what he stands for and what he represents.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to join in with a question or a comment here, so let's go to the telephone and pick up and go to a listener waiting for us in Champaign, line one. Hi.
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 I don't know if it's really a comment or a question, but I'll put it out there. What it seems to me from what I know about marketing... it's really that the marketing, the principles, the ideas kind of came from how religion mm-hmm. was always proselytized mm-hmm. in a way. I mean, so it's not anything new.
Right.
It's been over time. Now we've got the web. Now we have TV. Now, you know, all these other ways of reaching the faithful. And so we're exploiting them, or not me, but, you know, the people who are doing it are exploiting those ways. But even in ancient times, as religions were developing and coming forth, they used whatever means they had, and back then was word of mouth, discipleship, things of that sort, to spread the word. I mean, in marketing, that's what we do when we go selling. When we're salespeople are sent out, they are spreading the word about our products. I mean, a lot of our marketing concepts come from religion. So I don't know if it's that revolutionary an idea that, you know, about, you know, branding religion. It's actually just doing what it's always been done.
You could have written one of the chapters in the book that was well done. What I actually look at early on in the book is the process through which you take on a product as part of your personal identity versus the what's known as the religion career or the conversion career. And when you take on a consumer product as part of your identity, what happens is that you may see the marketing for it, you see the advertising and so on. You make it part of your consideration set. You buy the product, and at that point, a producer would consider you converted. And then the product company will do certain things to make you feel good about your purchase, and then they want you, through word of mouth, to tell other people, to be a marketing evangelist. And the same thing is true when you join a church. And, in fact, what you may do is come to the church and be a seeker, and you may sit sort of in the back of the church. And then you attend over time. You make relationships with people in the church. You become a member, and then you begin to profess your faith. People do other things to make you feel more comfortable about your decision, and then you become an evangelist and bring other people. The difference in those two processes, one, obviously taking on a religion as part of your personal identity has larger ramifications than buying a tube of toothpaste.
Well, right. But even as marketers, we see that, like, even a car, mm-hmm. you know, the image that the car portrays of you can be pretty deep for some people and not for others. The same with the religion.
Yep.
It can be very deep for some people and not for others,
yep.
even though they claim
mm-hmm.
to be of that faith.
Mm-hmm.
My point was only just, we're not really talking about anything different. It's just that we maybe got some really outrageous numbers, although if you think about Walmart, those numbers are pretty outrageous too. it's kind of like, if you think about Walmart and what they do, it's kind of like a mega church too.
Right.
So I don't see a lot of differences, and in fact, I see it almost the other way around,
mm-hmm.
that it's the marketers that have learned from the
yep.
religious faith on
yep.
what to do. And
mm-hmm.
it's spreading the word. So that's
yeah.
all.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I absolutely agree with you. And the point of it is what's really funny is that people have made such a big to-do about the fact that religions are marketing themselves. And by and large, you will hear people say what a terrible thing this is. And what I'm saying is that, one, I don't think it's a terrible thing, and two, that marketers actually stole this process from religion, and religion's just sort of taking it back again. So exactly to your point.
Yeah, we're talking this afternoon with Mara Einstein. She's the author of Brands of Faith, Marketing Religion in a Commercial Age. You know, that was one of the questions that I had, you know, when I sat down with the book and started thinking about it. And there's also a wonderful story you tell early in the book about the marketing of the Passion of Christ.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and my question was, as I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, you know, is all this a crass attempt to make a buck, or is it an effort by believers to spread the word, capital W,
mm-hmm.
word?
Right.
Or both?
I think it can be both, and I think the biggest issue becomes when certain institutions start using some of these more sophisticated marketing techniques, and then they begin to confuse the marketing with the word. And what I mean by that is if you watch Joel Osteen, if you watch his television program, that's part of the marketing. If you pick up The Purpose Driven Life, Rick Warren's book, that's part of the marketing. Even attending a seeker service, which is trying to get people in the door, that's all part of the marketing. And I think anyone who has any kind of really serious faith practice knows that it takes a lot more work than just showing up on Sunday morning for half an hour. And that's the issue with some of these marketing practices being applied to faith. So, for instance, if you have a seeker service, there's seeker services that are only 30 minutes long. And the whole idea is that they're trying to compete with other leisure time activities, not just faith, but other leisure time activities. And so you want to make sure you're going to do something that people will be interested in doing. Well, getting them to show up for a seeker service is really nice, but are you really supplying them with the faith? Are you really giving them something? Maybe you are. I'm not sure that it's a faith practice. I'm not sure that it's the word, as you say. And so that may be a little bit confusing for people. But I think the other thing about this, too, and going to the caller's question, marketing is so much more than just advertising. I think one of the confusions that people have is that when they think of marketing, they think of advertising. But it's not just that. Marketing is about understanding who your target audience is and then creating a product that is going to serve them. Well, that's fine if you're talking about a car or you're talking about a computer. But with a faith practice or with a religion, you know, at what point do you start changing the faith and then start playing around with what is the belief system? It's okay to repackage it. I don't have any problem with repackaging it. I think that that's probably really fine. What happens when you start getting into changing the faith? I don't know. That's a theologian question. That's not a question I can really answer. Yeah.
What can you tell us about what people talked with you about in terms of people of faith negotiating all of this in good faith?
Well, it was interesting because for a lot of people, and particularly if you're talking about evangelicals, one of the things that is really pushed right now is this idea of a personal relationship with the divine or a personal relationship with Jesus. And that, it, from a marketing perspective, is a really saleable point. That's something that people understand and people really want at this particular point in time. What a lot of people were concerned with, however, was the issue of, well, that's really fine to work on your personal relationship with Jesus, but what about following in his footsteps? Yeah. What about actually going out and helping the poor? What's happening to the social gospel in this sort of time period of having a personal relationship with Jesus? It's all fine to get yourself straightened out. It's all fine to make your life better, but what about helping the poor? What about, you know, clothing the naked and so on and so forth? And so there were issues with people that next step wasn't being taken, and that was a real concern. The other concern was what I mentioned before in terms of the Kabbalah Center. There were people that I talked to there who said that it was a real issue for them. It was a real struggle for them in terms of they liked what the Kabbalah Center gave them or presented to them in terms of what they got from a spiritual perspective, but they really wondered sometimes when an event cost over $150 when it could have cost $26 or something like that. And one of the things that the Kabbalah Center does is charges a certain amount of money based on numerology. And, you know, you can pick whatever numerology principle you want to pick, and sometimes they end up with a higher number and sometimes they end up with a lower number, but having to spend a lot of money to attend a religious service was really an issue for some people.
Yeah. Something that was really interesting for me to learn, among many things in Brands of Faith, actually, is that religious organizations, and I guess I should have figured this out, but known this, it makes sense, religious organizations using consultants, focus groups, and surveys.
Well, that's what I mean by these sophisticated marketing tools. When a church, for instance, a new church is being planned, and it makes a tremendous amount of sense to do this, is to look at the demographics of the area where you're going to be. And so you want to be in a place where there's going to be an increased number of young families because that's the group that you're going to be able to serve. If, the Rick Warren's church, the Saddleback Church, used Disney consultants, and they're not the only ones. And simple things, I mean, things that McDonald's knows. One of the basic principles of McDonald's is you always have a clean bathroom. Well, the mega churches use the same idea because that's one of the key things that's going to turn people off to your institution. It's things like making sure that there's parking for people that are coming to try out your church that's closest to the church door. So you want to do things that are going to serve the people that are looking to your institution. Doing door-to-door surveys, again, to find out what people are looking for and what their needs are in that particular community. And then translating that, you mentioned the story of Mel Gibson and the Passion of the Christ. I mean, the marketing on that was really brilliant. And one of the things that I thought was really well done, what, as a marketer, what you want to do is to get people moving in the direction that they're already moving. While most films are opened on a Friday night, when people are thinking about what they're going to do for their weekend, The Passion of the Christ was opened on Ash Wednesday. Because what other day, except perhaps Christmas or Easter, are people thinking about Jesus? That's going to be a prime day when they're thinking about him.
Ash Wednesday is even better than, you know, Good Friday might have been okay,
right,
too. But
right, but maybe too many people were going to be at church. So, you know, so Ash Wednesday. But also this idea of using churches as places to sell products, books, The Veggie Tales, which is a children's evangelical series, was incredibly sold through churches. And so what happens is that pastors become unpaid spokespeople for different products. And that's what happened with The Passion of the Christ. They provided private screenings for pastors. They did this a tremendous amount in the Colorado area with a large number of mega churches, and Focus on the Family is out there and so on. And then they asked the pastors to then buy blocks of tickets or buy out an entire theater so that they could bring their congregation. Well, what better way to sell a movie than have your pastor tell you that this is the movie that you should go and see? Mm-hmm. And so 3 million tickets were sold this way before the movie ever opened. The other thing that I love that they did was Mel Gibson created a message for pastors that were then left on their voicemail, and so then a pastor would come in the next morning and there'd be a message from Mel Gibson. And then, of course, he thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And then they would call everybody in and say, gosh, you got to listen to this message. Mel Gibson left me a message. So that's a use of viral marketing, which is also a very popular thing right now.
And also, a couple of weeks before the release of the film, pastors received pastor kits. And I guess, you know, it's like a lesson plan. It's all prepared.
Right.
And it's ready for you there to go. And
right, right.
You know, we make it easy for you.
Right. I mean, that happens. And even now there's something, Fox Family, or Fox Faith, Fox, like Fox TV, 20th Century Fox, they have a separate division now called Fox Faith. And it's all family-friendly and also some religious-based videotapes. And if you go onto the website, or if someone's running a Sunday school program and they go onto the website, they can find lesson plans, and then they can use video clips from these videos to help present their plan to their students.
Yeah. We see a lot of marketing efforts targeted at children, and you mentioned Veggie Tales.
Mm-hmm.
How else has the marketing of religion taken children into account?
Ah, oh, interesting question. Mostly where I saw that was as part of my research. I went to the CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association, retail event. And that takes place annually, and it's a really interesting thing to go to, because I went to the Denver Convention Center, this huge convention center, and everyone's there from HarperCollins San Francisco, which is a large book publisher, to Fox Faith was there, to somebody selling Jesus tattoos, you know, fake tattoos, not real tattoos, or scrapbooking and so on. But one of the biggest things that I saw there, two things. One was a lot of Sunday school materials were being sold there, and a lot of materials for people who were homeschooling. And so that's part of where it's presented to kids. It's interesting in terms of VeggieTales, because VeggieTales, unless you really know that it's an evangelical product, I'm not sure that you would see that right away. And even something and I talk about this in the book too, is there's some products that use a dual strategy, and they target a secular market and they target a religious market. So you have something like JJ the Jet Plane, which is a show that's on PBS, and in the PBS format, there isn't any religious language that's used. But there's also a video version of that that is presented with more cryptic language included in the videotapes, and then that doesn't go out over, that isn't broadcast, that people buy that.
Mm-hmm. How strongly do Americans today identify themselves with a particular denomination, and how has that changed over time?
They don't connect with denominations so much, and that's actually really interesting when you talk about megachurches. Most megachurches don't use a cross. Joel Osteen has a globe behind him. Willow Creek, there's no cross there. And so these churches that have been on the forefront of marketing don't use any kind of Christic iconography because they feel like it's something that's going to turn people away. Even something like the Kabbalah Center, they don't use the word God. They use the light because they believe people have too many negative connotations with the word God. So they even go so far as to move away from that. But in terms of people's belief, most surveys have come out and said 90% of Americans believe in some kind of higher power. But the other statistic that's really interesting is only 26% of Americans attend a religious service on a mm-hmm. weekly basis. And that may go up to about 40% if you want to say a monthly basis. So at least 50% of Americans are finding their faith outside of a religious institution. So they're not connecting themselves to a denomination of one sort or another. So that's what's really interesting in all of this, too. A lot of the marketing of religion or what we're seeing in terms of the increase of the marketing of religion is tied to the proliferation of the media and our ability to be able to practice outside of the walls of a religious institution. So we may be getting our faith from books. We may be getting our faith from watching a television program. Mm-hmm. We may be at a para-church group. We may be in Second Life, going to a virtual church in Second Life.
Yeah, and we can TiVo this or download mm-hmm. a podcast as mm-hmm. well, so we can do it whenever we want.
Exactly. And that's what's really interesting with someone, again, like Joel Osteen, because he does this better than anybody else, is if you watch his television show, it's really, I call it a cross between Dr. Phil and an infomercial, because you get this feel-good, I can go out and conquer the world kind of feeling after you finish watching the program. And yet at the same point, on the bottom of the screen, there's always information about how to go to his website and sign up for the podcast, or go to the website and watch the entire service, or buy his best-selling New York Times bestseller, or sign up for daily inspirational emails. And so it's always something about selling him, go see him on tour, whatever it is. So it's constantly selling him. And it's interesting because if you watch his show on television, it's a 30-minute show with very little mention of God. Maybe one or two scripture quotes will come up onto the screen. But if you watch the same thing online, you get all the Christic language. You get all the mentions of God. So it's a very different thing. The TV show becomes part of the marketing, and the online space can actually carry more of the faith system.
Hmm. You mentioned Dr. Phil. I want to talk about another brand, and that's the Oprah Winfrey mm-hmm. brand. And she's here in Brands of Faith, and she's doing something that you point out that I think is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not too much,
mm-hmm.
but we are serving a higher power on
right.
her program.
Right.
Talk with us about her message and how she came to the place that she is in today.
Yeah. Well, Oprah's really interesting because her television talk show was pretty similar to most others that were out there until the mid-90s, and she decided that if she was going to continue to do her talk show, that she was going to provide information and entertainment in the service of a higher power. And she actually talks about her show being her ministry, not on her show, but she's talked about that in the trade press. And so in the late 90s, she introduced her Angel Network, which allowed her to raise money through her audience and give that to different groups that were doing good works around the country. She had also at one point introduced a 5-minute segment at the end of her program that Remembering Your Spirit. And she was really criticized, highly criticized for that as being too religious. And so she had to get rid of it. And what's interesting is it really wasn't that religious. It really was spiritual, but it was also very practical spirituality. In the same way that Joel Osteen has a practical spirituality, she has a practical spirituality. So it was in the sense of you should learn to meditate, but you should learn to meditate because it's going to help you be more calm when you're dealing with your children. So there wasn't anything particularly religious about it. But what's interesting now is if you watch her program, well, she doesn't have a time period set aside to talk about faith or spirituality. She does have a lot of content that has, she doesn't mention Jesus, but she does mention God often, and she talks about parables. She uses the idea of God gives you a rock, and then he gives you a brick, and then he gives you a brick wall, and as a way for you to be able to learn any kind of lesson you need to learn in your life. She talks about her guests' appearances on their show as being their testimony. She uses the idea of gratitude and thankfulness and forgiveness, and all of these are very, very religious kinds of principles. One of the more interesting things that she's done is every year she has this Christmas show, and it used to be that she would give away all of these products, very expensive products, whatever the newest, latest thing was. And in 2006, what she did instead is she gave everybody in her audience a $1,000 gift card. But the trick of that was that they had to go out and pay it forward, the idea of giving back to somebody else. And she gave them all a video camera to tape how they did and what they did with that $1,000. And whoever did the best in terms of service was shown on a subsequent program. And so one woman had gone out and got her community together, and there was a man, I believe, was dying of brain cancer, or had brain cancer, and she was able to pay off his medical bills and turn that $1,000 into almost $100,000 and so on and so forth. That idea was supposed to be turned into a primetime television show, which didn't materialize that summer, but may yet show up on her new cable network. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. Well, VeggieTales, back to VeggieTales, that seems to me to be a little bit about the golden rule.
Mm-hmm.
And Oprah, what you've just been talking about is the importance of doing good works.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be something that, whether you're religious or not,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion.
Right.
But I want to talk about these, instead of denominations today in churches and synagogues and so forth, we have faith communities,
mm-hmm.
and they might be brick and mortar, they might be electronic, they might be virtual. The role of these communities in the larger culture, and back to Oprah, mm-hmm. she has endorsed Barack Obama, and we have religion playing a role in both the Republican and Democratic primaries.
Uh-huh.
So maybe before we run out of time, I'd really be interested in your thoughts about the role of mega faith communities in the larger culture and in politics in particular.
Right. Well, the last part of the book, what I look at is the consequences of marketing religion, and there is actually a whole chapter about that. In particular, my concern has been when you look at a large megachurch institution, and for legal purposes, they're not allowed to endorse a particular candidate, but they can, in fact, say, vote your values or vote Christian, and that can communicate volumes to people. So if you have a congregation that serves 20 or 30 or 40,000 people, it becomes very simple to be able to communicate that message to a large number of people very, very quickly. In terms of branding, we can see how that was translated in terms of what went on with Mitt Romney versus Huckabee. Huckabee being a Baptist minister to evangelicals, that was an immediate branding message. People went, okay, I understand what that means. He believes in what I believe in. Okay, that's fine. At the same point, if you have Mitt Romney as being a Mormon, people don't have that immediate understanding of what Mormonism is. For some people, it probably means polygamy. For some, it means, oh, they used to not let African Americans practice, and now they do. But it doesn't. It's not a positive for him. And so in that sense, branding becomes an issue. What also has happened is because religion became such an issue in terms of the political process 4 years ago, the Democrats wanted to make sure they weren't left out of the conversation. And so when the Lakewood Church was relaunched in 2005 or 2006, whatever, Nancy Pelosi showed up. So the Democrats understood that this was a community that they could not afford to ignore. And while they may not change all of their ideals in terms of it, it was certainly a group of people that needed to be paid attention to.
Very interesting. There's one other thing. We're running out of time here pretty quickly, but before we go, I want to have you talk about, tell a story that involves the website www.brandsoffaith.com, and this has to do with juicy.com, and here you have the Juicy promo video from YouTube. What a great example, as you say, of marketing religion in today's environment, and it's very entertaining.
It's incredibly entertaining. I was actually doing some research for something else, and I found that video. And part of it was, and I don't want people to be turned off by this, the cover of the book has very cryptic imagery on it. And I don't just talk about Christianity. I do talk about Judaism in there in the book. And so it's not just a Christian issue. But in terms of, and this is something we hadn't talked about, one of the reasons why we're seeing this growth in marketing, or we're seeing it so in our face, is that we don't have to practice the faith of our family. And so religious organizations, if they want the next generation of people to be sitting in those seats, they have to do something that's going to attract them. And so this Juicy video, and I do recommend people go check it out, is very well produced. It really targets a sort of a young 20s sensibility in terms of what religion has to offer them, and why it's something that they need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that was really it. But you see, but it's interesting because you see Juicy T-shirts. Juicy, J-E-W-C-Y, as opposed to Juicy Couture. But again, it's spinning off those things that are already in the culture and having religious faiths use them. iGod is another example, taking off the whole idea of iPod, something that would appeal to younger people. Using the idea of iGod is also something that does the same sort of thing.
Well, not your grandfather's synagogue, your grandfather's... Not your grandfather's church.
No, it's not.
No, it's
something
a changed
very, very
world.
Different.
Very interesting. Mara Einstein, thank you so much for talking with me
this
afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Mara Einstein is the author of Brands of Faith, Marketing Religion in a Commercial Age. The book is published by Routledge. For more information about the book and our guest, you can visit the website www.brandsoffaith.com. Our guest, Mara Einstein, is an associate professor of media studies at Queens College, as well as an adjunct professor in the Stern School of Business at New York University.